Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart in this week for Leonard Lopate. On Tuesday, President Obama gave his farewell address in Chicago. For this week's bonus weekend podcast, we are re-airing Leonard's conversation with Barack Obama in 2004, back when he was a senator from Illinois. And in 2007, Leonard spoke with Joe Biden, then senator from Delaware. Enjoy.
For alongside our famous individualism, there's another ingredient in the American saga. A belief that we're all connected as one people. If there is a child on the south side of Chicago who can't read, that matters to me even if it's not my child. If there's a senior citizen somewhere who can't pay for their prescription drugs and having to choose between medicine and the rent, that makes my life poorer even if it's not my grandparent. If there's an Arab American family being rounded up without benefit of an attorney or due process, that threatens my civil liberties. It is that fundamental belief. It is that fundamental belief. I am my brother's keeper. I am my sister's keeper that makes this country work. It's what allows us to pursue our individual dreams and yet still come together as one American family. E pluribus unum, out of many, one.
I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Before the Democratic National Convention in July, few people outside Illinois had even heard of Barack Obama. At that time, he was the state senator representing Chicago who'd been selected by the local Democratic Party to run for an open U.S. Senate seat. But Mr. Obama's keynote address at the convention seemed to touch a chord with many Americans and thrust him into the national spotlight. In November, he won that election and will soon begin serving the U.S. Senate as the U.S. Senate's only black member. Senator Obama's keynote address has been included in a new paperback edition of his memoir, Dreams from My Father. The book is published by Three Rivers Press, and I'm very pleased and honored that it has brought him to my show today. Hello.
Great to be here. Thank you, Leonard.
So you've gone from being Senator Obama to Senator Obama.
You know, I don't have to change the title on my cards, but obviously I think we're going to have more work to do in Washington than we've been doing in Springfield.
Were you as surprised as many New Yorkers are reported to have been that John Kerry didn't win the election?
I felt that it was going to be close throughout. You know, when you're running against one of the best political operations in modern history and a wartime president who is personally popular, although his policies are not, I think we all knew that that was going to be a tough race. I think that there were some key points during the campaign where we let some opportunities slip away, and John Kerry ultimately just had too much ground to make up right at the end.
Well, your speech was about inclusion. So how concerned are you by just how divided the country seems to be?
You know, I think some of the division's overstated. One of the points I think I was trying to make in my speech is that the American people are a non-ideological people. I think that they carry with them a lot of contradictory impulses. I think we're a tolerant people, but we're concerned about maintaining traditions and upset by some of the tumultuous nature of our culture. I think we are a people that likes to think of ourselves as peace-loving, but also have been severely traumatized by 9/11. I think that when you look at the real divisions between the blue states and the red states, you have to remind yourself that 45% of the people voted for John Kerry in the red states and 45% of the people in the blue states voted for George Bush. I do think that the vitriol, the sort of slash and burn, anything goes politics that's become the custom in Washington has eroded our capacity to get things done. And that's what I am concerned about.
Well, Alan Keyes did that to some degree during your campaign, but it didn't work. Was he just too far behind?
Well, first of all, he's from Maryland, and so that was sort of a problem for him.
It did look like a carpetbagger situation,
right? But I think more importantly, he was so over the top that I think it ended up being almost comic. You know, when he starts saying that Jesus Christ wouldn't vote for me, I wanted to, you know, ask him who his pollster was, because you know, if he's got the direct line to Jesus Christ, I've got other questions I want to find out about. You know, am I going up or down after this whole thing is over with?
Well, Sam Brownback might have said the similar thing, and he got 60 or 70% of the vote in Kansas.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of it was his tone was harsh and nasty. But part of it is also Illinois, I think, is in some ways really a microcosm of the country. It's north, south, it's east, west, it's urban and rural, and it's blue and it's red. You know, there's a blue portion of Illinois and there's a red portion of Illinois. And in those red portions, I did well because I had been to these areas and I know these people. And they remind me of my grandparents. You know, when I go out to a farm community out in downstate Illinois and I'm talking to people, they remind me of my grandparents who were raised in Kansas.
You mentioned earlier that some people are concerned about defending or maintaining their traditions. Now, we're talking about a lot of different traditions, so is that part of the problem right now?
I think that is part of the problem. I mean, you know,
some people see it as the old America, and then others see it as defending who they are and where they come from.
Well, you know, this country has always had this set of warring impulses between inclusion and exclusion, between sorting out our complexities through tolerance and scapegoating, and it alternates back and forth. And I think that part of my task politically is to try to appeal to the what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature, and that's a deep strain in American politics and history, and I think that it's been suppressed a little bit over the last several years. I'd like to see it resurface.
Somebody has dubbed our times as the post-truth decade.
Well, I do think that we've actually returned to a period that existed for, you know, many decades in this country where the media was not seen as the objective arbiter of fact and truth, but rather is a collection of highly partisan, opinionated voices. I mean, people forget that, for example, in Chicago, the Chicago Tribune, owned by Colonel McCormick, who was a rabid and staunch Republican, they didn't understand this notion that you'd separate the editorial page from the front page. That was an organ by which, McCormick, in the same way that Hearst and other newspaper magnates bent the public will in accordance to their views. But, you know, we had this golden age, I guess. We dated back to Edward E. Murrow and Cronkite, and in which I think the media stood outside of that. And now I think it you do see in you know, Fox News and other stations a much more opinionated point of view. I think ultimately facts are important, though. I don't think that you shape facts to your ideology. I think you try to shape your ideology to the facts on the ground. And I think, you know, my primary criticism probably of the Bush administration is not that they are bad people or evil people, but rather they have a tendency to ignore facts when they get in the way of their ideological predispositions.
But you're going into a Senate that is more strongly under the control of the Republican Party than it has been, I don't know, since perhaps the first part of the 20th century.
Well, it probably hasn't been that long. I mean, you know, people tend to, you know, Bob Dole was the head of the Senate
But the Democrats controlled the House.
I mean, what is true is you've got Republicans are in control right now, and I do think that there is a sharper ideological bent to the Republicans that control all the branches of government than we've seen in quite some time. And I think that the danger is for the Republican Party is that they overreach. The danger for the country is that ideology ends up causing us a lot of long-term problems.
Well, when the Democrats control the House and the Senate, many supporters of the party felt that they made too many concessions, that they really did try to rule by consensus and brought the Republicans in to the decision-making process. And we're not seeing that now. First of all, what does that mean for someone like you entering the Senate? Do you think you'll be marginalized?
Well, look, you know, the wonderful thing about the institution of the Senate, and also the problem with an institution like the U.S. Senate, is that every single one of the 100 senators has some power by virtue of the filibuster, by virtue of the fact that the calendar is set by unanimous consent. It means that if the party in the majority tries to run roughshod over the minority, things can be slowed down to a halt. Now, my preference would not be to engage in that kind of practice. Look, you know, George Bush called me the day after the election, and he congratulated me on his victory. And I said, you know, Mr. President Bush, you know, I am not rooting for your failure. I'm rooting for your success. I want to see you solve the situation in Iraq, and I want to see us stabilize Social Security and simplify the tax code. And, you know, I hope that we can find common ground. And that is my attitude. And so when the president says, for example, that he wants tax reform, I say to him, let's go. I'm all for tax reform. But my parameters of the tax reform that makes sense to me involves making sure that it's not more regressive than it currently is, that we don't put more of a burden on low-income and middle-class taxpayers, and we try to make the system more fair as well as more simple. Now, if they try to come at us with things that are going to shift the burden significantly off of the wealthy and onto the middle class, as they've done, I think, over the last several years, then I will have no problem in saying no. And I think it will be important for us to find the tools to modulate some of the harsher aspects of some of the policies I suspect are going to be forthcoming.
My guest is Barack Obama. His best-selling memoir, Dreams from My Father, has just been reissued by Three Rivers Press with the complete text of his keynote address to the 2004 Democratic Convention. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. So how did you come to be chosen as the keynote speaker at the convention?
Well, you know, keep in mind the context of this race. You know, when I announced that I was running for the U.S. Senate 2 years ago, I think the general estimation in Illinois was that I probably would be the best U.S. senator, but I didn't have much of a chance of winning because I had no money, I had no organization support, and I had this ballot name that just made people go crazy. They said, you know, nobody can pronounce it. How are you ever going to be able to get votes?
But they do remember it.
But they do remember it once they get it. And we ended up having an extraordinarily successful primary victory. We ended up winning not only the black vote, but the white vote, suburban vote, as well as the city vote. We won in downstate, primarily agricultural districts that nobody would have anticipated somebody like myself winning. And so I think it created a sense of hopefulness coming out of that primary that I could beat somebody who spent $30 million or the anointed choice of the Democratic machine. And it made people feel good. Now, John Kerry then came to campaign with me, and I think saw me speak at an event for him. And I guess they were favorably impressed. And so a couple of weeks before, probably about a month before the convention, they called and asked if I'd be interested in speaking.
And you went from being a guy who didn't have a chance in the primary to someone who some people are suggesting might be a future presidential candidate.
Yeah, it's a pretty big leap. I don't take the presidential talk too seriously. I'm ranked 99th in seniority in the Senate. I'll be
didn't hurt John Edwards.
I'll be sharpening pencils for a while and carrying the bags of Carl Levin and Pat Leahy.
But so it's like joining a football team. You got to do all the rookie things.
Absolutely. I'm sure there's a hazing that I'm going to have to be going through. But you know, my job right now is to represent the people of Illinois. They're the ones who sent me there. I've got to set up a good constituent service office. I actually think that Hillary Clinton has been a terrific model for me because she has been an outstanding senator for the state of New York. And I think that it does you no good to try to go national before you've really taken care of your home base.
You're only the third black man in the Senate since Reconstruction, and one of them was a Republican from Massachusetts.
Right, right. But yeah, I mean, we haven't had many. We've had five African-Americans in the United States Senate out of the 1,800 or so that have served. And obviously that comes with it some heightened visibility. It means that I get 200 invitations a week to speak, and I haven't been sworn in yet. Every NAACP Freedom Fund dinner all across the country. And I have no qualms about serving as a role model for young African-Americans who may seek some inspiration and be interested in public service. I certainly intend to speak out forcefully on issues like the Voting Rights Reauthorization Act that have a specific impact on the African-American community. But ultimately, the people who sent me here were all the people of Illinois. And it's going to be important for me to make certain that everybody who I'm representing feels that they're getting equal time from me.
Well, you identified yourself as an African-American. I think most people would. And yet this is, to some degree, a self-identifying thing, isn't it? Tiger Woods resists.
Right.
And you could just as easily describe yourself in a lot of other ways, couldn't you?
Well, that's part of what the book is about. I wrote it 10 years ago when some publishers came to me. I had been elected as the president of the Harvard Law Review and received my first 15 minutes of fame. And I wrote the book, and it was, I think, not exactly what they expected, because it was much more of a meditation on issues of race and identity. And my father was from Kenya. My mother was a white Kansan. They met in Hawaii. And, you know, so I
had, and you spent a lot of time in Indonesia.
And I spent a lot of time in Indonesia and Southeast Asia. And I have a sister who's half Indonesian. She's married to a Chinese American. You know, when we get together, it's the United Nations. And so it's true that in some ways, how we think about race is a construct. Different people make different choices. I think it was always important for me to identify myself as African-American, partly because I think of the African-American community as a hybrid people by definition. And we have all sorts of strands in us, European and African and
Native American.
And to some degree, we are an extension of the larger American family, which is a hybrid nation and a hybrid people. But part of it is also, you know, I'm very resistant to this notion that I should try to wiggle out of my African-American identity. As I pointed out to somebody who asked me about this, you know, if I had gotten arrested for armed robbery and my face was on the evening news, nobody would have had any qualms about describing me as a black male. They wouldn't have said, well, this mixed race gentleman was arrested. You know, if I'm hailing a cab out in the street and folks are passing me by, they're not asking for my ID to see what my DNA is. And, you know, so if I'm African-American at that end of the spectrum, then I'm African-American when I'm elected to the United States Senate as well.
My guest is Barack Obama. His memoir, Dreams from My Father, A Story of Race and Inheritance, is available in paperback now from Three Rivers Press. It includes the complete text of his 2004 Democratic Convention keynote address, and it's been a bestseller ever since it was reissued. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break here on WNYC. Barack Obama is here. His Dreams from My Father has just been issued in a new edition, which includes the complete text of his keynote address to the 2004 Democratic Convention. It's published by Three Rivers Press, and it's been on the paperback bestseller list since it was re-released in August. How well did it do when it was first published in 1995?
You know, I think it hit the bargain table about 2 weeks out. after it was published. I was very proud of the book, and I wrote a new preface for this one, and I talked about the fact that, you know, when you're a first-time author, I'd never written a book before. I think you're filled with both this trepidation that you're going to make a fool out of yourself, and then in the back of your mind, you're thinking, I'm going to be, you know, on the cover of the New York Times review, you know, book review. And I think that it ended up being somewhere in the middle, which is the experience of most authors. I was very proud of the book. It got some nice reviews, but it sort of drifted away. And so this has been a little bit of serendipity that as a consequence of my political career, ironically, people are more interested in reading the book.
Well, in a recent piece in the New York Times, Janet Maslin said that your book escaped being deadly dull, like many by politicians, because you wrote it before you were well known.
You know, I'm sure that there is some truth to the fact that you know, when you're not in the public eye and you write, you dig a little deeper and you're willing maybe to expose yourself a little more. But the interesting thing is that I find part of my recent political success is attributable to the fact that I try not to be too pre-programmed, and I try to be intellectually honest and you know, admit when I have doubts or am not always on point. And I think that that's something that people are hungry for in politics, is just a sense of authenticity, that you know we're not all pre-programmed and are on the talking point list every time we speak.
But, of course, that makes you vulnerable to some criticism.
It does.
You could be a flip-flopper if you don't say, yes, I said that 20 years ago, I said that 10 years ago, and I say it now.
Well, look, there's no doubt that it makes you vulnerable. But the truth is, as we've seen, I think, in recent politics, you know, if somebody wants to run negative ads on you, they can run negative ads on you. I don't think people are constrained by the truth. The Swift Boat ads were not based on fact. They were based on largely fabrication. And
should John Kerry have approached them differently? You said he made some mistakes during the campaign.
Well, I think he himself would probably agree that they thought it would drift away because the claims were so incredible. And in retrospect, you know, hindsight is 20/20. I think that if he had just shown some quiet outrage, it wouldn't have had to be a big production. Maybe a 5-minute talk saying, you know, you can challenge my position on Vietnam and my position after the war, but the notion that you would challenge my service, I think, is outrageous. If he had done something like that, I think that it would have shamed the other side a little more than and it wouldn't have gotten out of hand as it did.
Jeff Danziger, the political cartoonist, did a cartoon in which a medic is applying a bandage to a wounded soldier, and he says, the good news is that this is not a serious wound. You'll get a Purple Heart. The bad news is you can never run for president.
Right.
Well, you must regret, and now that you are in national office, some of the information you've included in this book, like smoking pot when you were in school. Although,
you know, I really don't regret that. I tell you what, I claim my entire life with all its upsides and downsides. And part of the reason that I wrote about these episodes in my life when I was troubled is because, you know, there's so many African-American boys out there who don't have a father in the house, who are living in much harsher conditions than I was, who had far fewer opportunities than I did, who are making the same mistakes that I was at that time, but the environment's less forgiving, and so, you know, when they slip, they fall a lot further. And it was important for me, I think, to suggest some of the psychology that goes into the oppositional culture that develops among minority youth, and then also to suggest that you can pull yourself out of it.
Well, do you think there's, well, there are a number of differences. First of all, your father was from Africa.
Right.
He was not an African-American.
Right.
And didn't come through that whole legacy
right.
that so many African-Americans talk about.
Absolutely.
You know, grandparents who were slaves.
Yeah. Although, you know, the interesting and part of what brings this book full circle is when I go back to Kenya and you discover that, you know, my grandfather, who was perceived as a big man among his tribe, was also a cook and a houseboy for, you know, white colonial settlers, and had to carry a passbook around wherever he went. And so, you know, there's actually some connection between blacks in Africa and the diaspora in terms of their experience. But, you know, more importantly, I think, at least for me when I was a teenager, was the fact that, like many African Americans, even those who are in the South Side of Chicago or in Harlem or Brooklyn, there weren't that many African-American male role models. And so, you know, I joke about the fact that, you know, when I was coming up back in the 70s, and I'm in Hawaii where there are very few African-Americans, you know, the only black men you were seeing on TV were either Shaft or Geraldine. You know, that was Flip Wilson's transvestite character. And so, you know, given the choice between Shaft and Geraldine, I decided Shaft was the better role model. And you know, so you end up taking on these exaggerated attributes of black manhood that, you know, you still see today. And you know, these kids who, you know, they may be growing up in suburban environments and they're still wearing their pants down around their knees. And
a lot of white kids are as well.
Exactly.
But you also grew up without knowing your father. You only met him once while you were growing up. So you were a black kid in Hawaii, where you probably felt closer associating with the Hawaiian locals right. than you did with the Haoles.
Right, right, right. Look.
And then Indonesia, people, very similar skin tone, but...
Right. Well, and actually, growing up in Jakarta, which was a fascinating place for a six-year-old boy to grow up, this was right after the coup that had expelled Sukarno from power. And... about 500,000, 750,000 people who were perceived as communist sympathizers had died. And, you know, being there, actually what I felt most acutely was my Americanness, right? The fact that there was this huge divide between the haves and the have-nots, one that was far more exaggerated than what you saw in the United States. And it gave you some appreciation of the wheel of fortune and how it turns, and the fact that you're born on one side of the line or the other had huge consequences for my life and the lives of my Indonesian friends.
You've said that if you had a chance to rewrite this memoir, you'd include more information about your mother. She is no longer with us. Was she alive when you wrote the book?
You know, she was, and then she, you know, tragically, at the age of 53, was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and it took her life in about 6 months. In fact, she died probably about a week or two before the book came out for publication. And she was just a wonderful woman. I mean, she was, everybody loves their mom, obviously, but I think everybody who knew her thought she was a special spirit, one of the kindest and wisest people that I will ever know. And you know, it's interesting. I write in the preface to the book that, you know, this ended up being much more of a meditation on the parent that was missing, because you take the one that's there for granted.
Your cell phone.
No, that was my bad, as they say. I thought I'd turned it off.
You also lived a lot with your grandparents, didn't
yeah.
you?
So I did.
White grandparents,
right.
Did they accept you?
Oh yeah, I mean
they love their daughter.
Oh, they love
their
daughter, and that, you know, my grandparents were fascinating people. They grew up in small Kansas towns. And my grandfather worked on an oil rig, graduated from high school, joined the army, fought in Patton's army, and my, you know, grandmother was Rosie the Riveter, and they got further education on the GI Bill and just moved west. And, you know, I write in my book that they, in some ways, could have never anticipated having a black African son-in-law or a black grandson, and yet they really, I won't say they were thrilled with it, but they accommodated it in a generous way that I will always thank them for. And I think it helped that we were in Hawaii because Hawaii was such a melting pot already that you didn't have some of the stark racial divides, or at least explicit racial divides, that you were seeing on the mainland of the United States.
Because there are so many people from other parts of
Absolutely.
Asia, a lot of Japanese,
right.
a lot of Filipinos.
And a lot of intermarriage among these various ethnic groups.
But considering the almost unique situation, Hawaii, then Indonesia, you wind up going to school here in New York,
right.
And then moving to Chicago.
Right. My biography is not the typical biography of a Chicago politician. I joked with somebody. One thing I can say for certain is that no other elected official in the history of Illinois has ever been able to speak Indonesian and with a Jakarta accent. So,
you keep that up?
I'm rusty at this point. But it is a very unusual biography for a state where its politicians typically are born into politics and inherit political organizations generation after generation. And I think that's part of the reason why people felt so encouraged after my election was a sense of, if a guy named Barack Obama with a father from Kenya and a mother from Kansas can get elected to the United States Senate, maybe anybody's got a shot.
Also a child of divorce.
Oh, absolutely.
You went to Chicago after Columbia University to become a community organizer?
Yeah. I graduated from Columbia, loved New York, I'd gotten involved in the anti-apartheid movement and other community activities and had decided that I wanted to get involved in community development in some way. I couldn't find a job in New York that paid the rent. I worked in Harlem for about 6 months. The organization ran out of funding. So there were a group of churches out on the far south side of Chicago that were trying to deal with the devastation of steel plants that had closed. And asked me if I'd be willing to come out for the grand sum of $13,000 a year to help organize job training programs and other activities in these hard-hit communities. And I drove out to Chicago sight unseen with all my worldly possessions in the back of a beat-up old car and loved the city. That's really occupies the middle third of the book, is just talking about how me working in low-income neighborhoods in Chicago, in the south side of Chicago, created not only a community for myself, a African-American community that I felt was home, but also I think gave me a clearer sense of who I was and as a consequence what my relationship might be to my father and my father's family. And so subsequently then, after doing that for 3 years, before I went to law school, I traveled to Africa, and that's how the book ends, is me essentially tracing my father's life and his father's life and getting a better sense of the journey that he had taken.
And were you ever able to really connect to your father and find out why things turned out the way they did?
You know, I did get a much stronger sense of the fact that, here was this African who had been born into a village. My grandfather was the first in his community to ever meet white people, period. We forget because I think, slavery was so long here that in Africa, colonialism was fairly recent.
Barack Obama's memoir, Dreams from My Father, is now available from Three Rivers Press with his 2004 Democratic Convention keynote address. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I look forward to being back again sometime.
Joe Biden has been a United States Senator from Delaware since 1973. Over that time, he's observed presidents Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Clinton, and two Bushes. But now he's running for president and promises to keep on life and politics which is published by Random House. Senator Biden recounts the personal tragedies and political victories he's experienced in office. We will talk about that and also why he thinks he should be president and what he would do about Iraq. I'm very pleased to welcome Joe Biden to the show. Hello.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's become common for presidential candidates to write memoirs that reveal parts of their character that the public may be unaware of. What do you think this book reveals about you that we haven't seen yet?
Well, I don't know that it reveals really anything that hasn't been seen or talked about over my career. I got elected when I was 29. I've been there for a while. There are still 43 or 44 senators older than me, so I've been hanging around a while, but with a lot of new people as well.
But you've been in the public spotlight for a long time, and anything you do has been scrutinized.
Yeah, and I think everything I write about in the book is there's nothing revealing in the sense that people didn't know it, but it's amazing. You know, one of the things you've got to realize in my business is that, my grandpa would say, Patty's a 9 days wonder. I mean, if you're not in the race, then, you know, you're easily, people don't know much about you. A lot of the reporters who covered me 20 years ago aren't covering politics anymore. And so it starts from scratch. And when I agreed to write this book, it was a fellow named Richard Ben Kramer who wrote What It Takes. And Richard started on me in the early 90s, trying to get me to write a book. He wanted me to write a book about, how my personal values and my experience have informed my public policy. And so in 2004, quite frankly, when I thought John Kerry was going to be president, I agreed with Random House to write this book and never thinking I was going to be running for president. So I'm not sure the book fits very well with running for president one way or another.
Well, what do you think has been the public perception of you since your announcement to run for president?
Well,
and I'd like you to be brutally honest.
Well, I think the perception is, as one of my pollsters told me, is that I am a guy who was the Secretary of State, born behind a podium, probably went to Yale University and comes from a wealthy family, which is the furthest thing from who I am. But when you think about it, I have been, according to the press, I've been on more of the talking head shows, the serious Sunday shows and the like in the last 6 years than anybody else. And every time anybody's heard anything from me, in the last 4 or 5 years, it's been on a single issue because I've not done any political shows until I decided to run. I've not done any political dinners in 20 years. I've not gone out and done the Democratic dinner in the state of California kind of thing. Not that there's anything wrong with those. I just decided not to do it because I wanted to focus on what I was doing. But the fact is, I don't think many people will remember that I was chairman of the Judiciary Committee or ranking member for 17 years. I presided over the Bork hearing, that I presided over the Thomas hearing. And it's
understandable. You don't think people will remember that? They watch you on television.
I think when it's recalled to them, they will. But I don't hold me to this number, but my understanding is, in terms of the number of people in America who recognize my name, it's more than half. But those who think they know enough about me to make a judgment about me is more like 20%. So I think we in politics, we have an inflated view of what we think people pay attention to.
Well, you mentioned that a lot of people think of you as Secretary of State, and you're often included in a list of potential U.S. Secretaries of State. Is that something that you welcome at all?
No. If I wanted to be Secretary of State, I surely wouldn't be running against the very people who would be the ones that are likely to appoint the Secretary of State. I'm running for president because I think that that I am not uniquely, but best suited right now, based on my career, my background, my experience, my track record, to deal with the most important problems facing the country now, which happen to fall in the category of national security, terrorism, and issues that affect the middle class at home here.
When you announced your candidacy for the Senate in 1972, you said, I'm running for the Senate because I want to make the system work again. Well,
yep.
It's 35 years later, and I'd guess that most Americans believe that the system still doesn't work. And I wonder why you think that is.
Well,
I know you couldn't have done it alone.
No. I think it's a fair question. But I think if you look at it, it runs in ebbs and flows. from 1972 when I ran, when no one had any faith in government. We went through a period for the next 12 to 14 years where people gained confidence in the government. Things began to change. A lot of good things did happen. The world changed for the better in the most part. We saw Latin America become democratic. We saw the Soviet Union fall. We saw some serious changes. I wrote a crime bill that put 100,000 cops in the street that brought down violent crime 8 years in a row. We wrote the Violence Against Women Act. But what happens in American history, like all history, is it tends to repeat itself. And what happened is we sort of ditched our ideals and our values, took on a new ideological philosophy, we began to dig ourselves into a deep hole, and we have to dig it back out. This is a constant fight. The reference I use sometimes, it's like cutting grass. You cut your grass this weekend, it looks great. You don't cut it for another 6 months, it looks terrible.
Well, when you made that rather brash promise for a political neophyte, you were a county council member.
I was.
And you went from county council member to running for the Senate at the age of 29?
Yes, I did. And it was purely accidental. I had no intention of running for the United States Senate. I came back from law school at Syracuse University in 1968 after Dr. King had been assassinated. And my city was in flames. My city, the city of Wilmington, was one of those cities that was major parts of were burned to the ground in riots. And I joined a group in my state to, quote, reform the Democratic Party. Most people think of the Delaware being an eastern or northeastern state. It really is more it's a border state. Two-thirds of my state considered itself south.
It's like Maryland.
It's like
parallel
Maryland.
With Maryland.
Yeah. And it was, we're part of the Delmarva, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia Peninsula.
Where
and
the so, chickens come from.
That's exactly right. $3 billion industry in that area. And so I guess the point I'm trying to make is that I came back and joined a group of reformers to try to bring the Democratic Party in line with the National Democratic Party as opposed to the Southern Democratic Party. And one thing led to another. No one would run against a very popular incumbent United States senator. I was appointed to a committee to help find someone, and the bottom line was the senior guy said, you do it. And so I did it, and I won by a landslide of about 3,000 votes.
My guest is Joe Biden. He's written a memoir called Promises to Keep on Life and Politics, published by Random House. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, you've been there for 35 years. I'm sure you never imagined when you were 29 that's what you'd be doing. How have relationships between senators on opposite sides of the aisle changed in those 35
Leonard,
years?
Leonard, they've changed drastically. When I first got to the Senate, I had no intention of staying in the Senate. I got elected in November the 3rd and November the 20th. I became old enough constitutionally. And November 18th, I lost my family or a big chunk of it in an automobile accident.
Some people would have dropped out of politics. It was just at the beginning of your career.
Well, I did. I announced that I was going to drop out of politics to my governor to appoint someone else. And there were great guys back then, both sides of the aisle, guys like Senator Mike Mansfield, people like a guy named Saxby, who was from the state of Ohio, Ted Kennedy, people who embraced me and convinced me to stay for, quote, 6 months. Then I could leave, help them organize. And little did I know that what they were doing for me probably, at least in an emotional sense, saved my life. I was raising my two boys. I started commuting. I've never lived in Washington since then. I never lived in Washington, period. And what happened was one thing led to another. But back in those days, when I first got there, there were some really interesting old guys who I had strong disagreement with. Southerners, the Southern Democrats, James O. Eastland, John Stennis, Herman Talmadge, all these guys. But the difference between then and now was we questioned each other's judgment, but motive was not questioned. Today, if you disagree with some, you are immoral. You are not a good Christian. You are not patriotic. I mean, it's
wasn't that way during the McCarthy era?
It was, but I wasn't there then. So I think, again, it's the ebb and flow of American politics. I think it was that way from what I read in the late 40s and through the 50s, but in the early 70s through the 80s, it wasn't that way.
Partly because the Democrats pretty much controlled Congress for much of that time.
Well, I think that's true. And I think what happened was...
And seniority is a key thing, controlling
that's right.
All of the committee chairmanships.
Well, I'll tell you a story. When I first got there, Mike Mansfield, who was the majority leader, a guy who most people would tell you had more integrity in his little finger than most people have in their whole body, used to have me come to his office once a week and give me an assignment. Looking back on it, he was basically taking my pulse after losing my wife and daughter to see if I was really focused. And I remember one day walking into his office and for my 3 o'clock appointment, he said, "How's it going?" And I just come off the floor of the Senate. And I said, "You know," I said, "I don't understand this." I said, "Here you got this guy, Jesse Helms, out there railing against the Americans with Disability Act. How could anybody be that?" I started to question his motive. And Mansfield just looked at me, took the pipe out of his mouth. He said, "What would you say, Joe, if I told you Jesse and Dot Helms, his wife, several years ago on the eve of Christmas, adopted a child who was wheelchair-bound in braces?" And I said, "Oh, my God, I'd feel awful." He said, "Well, that's exactly what they did." And he said, "Joe, don't question the motives of your opponents. Question their judgment."
There's been a lot of more turnover in the Senate over the last 20 years. Do you think that affects the ability to create bipartisan relationships?
Well, I think what's affected, I think that has some of it. But I think the other part of it is there's an awful lot of people beginning in 94 coming from the House of Representatives. And that's not a bad thing, except it's a very different ethic over there. And the system was designed to work differently than the Senate is designed to work. And it has always been more partisan. And quite frankly, the point you made earlier, the Democrats did not treat the Republicans very well in the House during that period of roughly 50 years they were in control. And when the House Republicans who got elected in the Gingrich Revolution came over, they were angry. John McCain used to refer to them as the Khmer Rouge. It became a lot more personal. And today, the ideological bent has become an impediment for people working together. It really is. People actually will get criticized if they work too closely with the other side, which is a big, big problem.
Does the seniority that you have and the fact that you're prominent on the national stage allow you to get more things done for your home state of Delaware?
Well, it does, Delaware is not very big on, doesn't have much of a tradition on, getting money for Lawrence Welk Museum kind of things. It helps Delaware because we're such a small state and have such a small constituent, a small congressional delegation. Having two senators, one of whom is very senior, allows us to at least get in the mix to get our fair share of needed bridge money, for example.
Well, that always something that people are concerned about, people outside of Congress. Is it possible to remain in office for 35 years without having to sometimes place the interests of the people of your home state above those of the American people?
Oh, I think it is. I mean, for example, I have done that a number of times and been rewarded for it by my constituents. For example, in the early 70s, I'm the guy that was asked, I was on a committee now called the Environment Committee, and I was asked to write a report about whether or not we should keep letting gasoline, phase it out, or eliminate it. And I wrote a report saying eliminate lead and gasoline, but the DuPont company had a patent on a thing called a lead trap. Had I written a report saying, no, you can have lead and gasoline, you just have to retrofit the exhaust pipe, it would have been $1 billion to the DuPont company. It was against my interest of my state, but it was in the interest of the country, and no one in my state punished me for that.
Do senators from the bigger states like California, Texas, and New York have to spend more or less time on national affairs or on bringing home the bacon to their
Well, I think it kind of depends on how they are viewed by their colleagues. And I know that seems non-responsive. But what happens in the Senate, your influence is in direct proportion to your ability to master a subject that gains the respect of your colleagues. For example, not talk about myself, let's take Bill Bradley. Bill Bradley and I were very close friends when he was in the Senate. There wasn't an issue relating to international finance. There wasn't an issue relating to the monetary system, all those kinds of issues. I didn't go speak to Bill. I'm an informed guy. I think I'm pretty smart, but I know Bill knew a great deal about it. So if you want to have an impact in the Senate, the way you have an impact is you decide either to be the guy who is going to be the ombudsman for your state. Remember, they used to kid Al D'Amato, Senator Pothole. Well, he did a great job for his state. But there was another senator at the same time, a good friend of mine, Pat Moynihan. And Pat Moynihan was able to survive in a big state by being a guy who was a man of big ideas and mastered other subjects. So it kind of depends on the route you choose to take.
You mentioned earlier that many people forget that you were the chairman of the Senate Committee on the Judiciary from 1987 to 1995 and presided over both the Supreme Court confirmation hearings of Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas. I wonder about how you were able to defeat the nomination of Bork but not Thomas, who had been accused of sexual indiscretions. Many people actually remain angry with you for not coming to Anita Hill's defense.
Well, I did come to. Well, let's take them one at a time. Bork, we were able to defeat because Bork was honest about his positions. We had a straight-up ideological debate, and he was straightforward, and I was convinced that if we had that debate, the American public was not prepared to go backwards on the expansion of individual rights, which he believed did not exist in the Constitution if they were not enumerated or stated. And that was a close fight in the committee, but it was Bork was straightforward, answered the questions, and it was a contest about where America wanted to go. With regard to the Clarence Thomas hearing, what people forget is we had a vote before Anita Hill even came around, before we knew about Anita Hill, and it was a 7-7 tie, which means he did not have technically enough votes to get out of the committee. But then when the Anita Hill thing broke, it became such a spectacle. One of the things that people talked about then was I did believe Anita Hill, and I did state that I believed Anita Hill. But one of the problems was that it became such a personalized battle and it became almost like a gigantic soap opera. I was told that over 150 million people worldwide watched that portion of the hearing. And what it implicated was, and why I believed it would, I said so before we got into it, it was about a major, major hidden issue in American society about harassment of women, which I had been on the forefront of trying to expose with the Violence Against Women Act and other things.
But Clarence Thomas made it into a racial thing.
Yeah, and he did. And so that's the point. You just stated the point. It became viewed as, on the one side, if you're against me, it's because I'm an African-American man. And on the other side, if you're for Anita Hill, it's because you are just a feminist who isn't concerned about whatever. And it got
very confused.
Except
Anita Hill was also an African-American. And
yes,
that
it was.
Should have eliminated
well,
the
it
whole
should
racial
have, but you watched it. You watched it unfold, and it didn't. And I thought the attacks on her were unfounded, but it got confusing, as you know. What people wanted me to do, some of the groups that were very upset with me, is that I wouldn't use the same tactics against him that were being used against her. But it seems to me that one of the things I feel very strongly about is process is as important as substance. I mean, process is what protects us all. And I remember one group coming to me and saying that, why don't you point out that he has watched pornography? You have you could go get his records. It's illegal to get his records from the video store. And my response was that, what would you say if I said to you, I'm the guy that wrote the Rape Shield Law, it's like saying, well, you know, go find out whether or not she had sex before. I said, look, there's a principle engaged here. And that got me in some real trouble for treating the hearing as if you needed evidentiary standards. Admittedly, you don't need them, but it seems to me there was a need to inject some standard in it. And at the end of the day, a bare majority of my colleagues stayed with President Bush and gave him his nominee. I strongly opposed it, and I think we were right to oppose him because I don't think he's been a very a judge who said he'd do what he would do.
Well, many people have claimed that the Robert Bork confirmation hearings actually was an important lesson for conservatives, because from that point on, people did not admit to their politics. They said, well, I will reserve judgment until the case comes before me.
And that's absolutely true.
Pretty much they have decided pretty much
exactly
based
right.
on what everybody assumed they would decide it on.
I think you're correct. That's why I wrote a major piece some years ago saying how I would change the confirmation process. That's why I was so strongly opposed Roberts and so strongly opposed Alito. I don't believe they were being straightforward with us, and I think their rulings demonstrate that it's inconsistent with what they led people to believe their philosophy was.
My guest is Joe Biden. He's written a memoir called Promises to Keep on life and politics. It's published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after this. We're talking with Joe Biden, who was elected to the Senate in 1972 when he was just 29 and immediately was faced with a terrible tragedy because of a car accident in which two sons, Beau and Hunt, were hurt but survived, but his wife, Nelia, and baby daughter, Naomi, died. And then here we are 35 years later and two presidential campaigns later talking about his career, his memoir called Promises to Keep on Life and Politics, published by Random House. You ran for president in 1988. How has the process of campaigning changed since then?
Well, it's changed a great deal. The amount of money allegedly needed to be able to compete is staggering. Candidates are talking about the need to raise $100 million in the primaries. The second thing that's changed is that when I ran last time, the early states in which you campaign, like Iowa, they had lost confidence in themselves because their states were in trouble, but they still had confidence in the country. Today, I find it the opposite. The states have some confidence in what's going on in their home states, but they're very concerned about our place in the world, what's going on in the country. I've never seen the American public as focused. I've seen them angrier. I've seen them more upset. But they are focused on the big ticket items. For example, I would be asked in the first five questions in someone's living room in Iowa or New Hampshire 22 years ago, I'd be asked about social issues. Almost without fail, every question now is about foreign policy, Iraq, or about health care. So they're really focused on major, major issues.
Although you did come to Congress at a time when we were still involved with the
yes.
Vietnam War.
Yeah, no, I came running against the Vietnam War. But at that point, by 72, all they wanted to know when you were running is, are you for it or against it? They had already made up their mind. They want to know where you were. Today, there is a sense when during Vietnam, and we're comparable ages, during Vietnam, whether you were for the war, against it, went, didn't go, the consensus was if we got out of there, we'd be able, there were no more shoes to drop, that we could attend to business at home. But nobody believes, in my view, that if we ended the war in Iraq tomorrow, we're safe in the world. No one believes if we ended the war tomorrow that we have a policy that has any prospect of settling things in the Middle East or the Korean Peninsula, et cetera. So it's a very different attitude about what happens even if we end this war.
Washington Post columnist Richard Cohn has said that your manic obsessive running of the mouth could be the character weakness that disqualifies you from competing with the front runners. And the other night, Hillary Clinton in the AFL-CIO debate said, though, that though she was, I assume, talking about Barack Obama, it's not good to always say what's on your mind when you run for president. So how do you respond to that?
As I called Richard when he wrote that article about a year ago, and I said, Richard, we'll find out. I consider him a friend and an honest reporter. We'll find out whether you're right. The public will make that judgment. If you notice in those debates, I'm the only one that keeps within my time. And I think I can't speak for Senator Clinton. I think you should say what you believe, but you don't always have to. Whatever you say should be what you believe. But you shouldn't say all the time what you believe about everything. And the point she was making was, if you were president of the United States, you surely would not publicly state ahead of time you're prepared to disregard the sovereignty of another country. You may have to do it, but do it. Don't talk about it.
Well, according to the USA Today Gallup poll that was released earlier this week, Hillary Clinton is at 48%, Barack Obama at 26%, Edwards at 12%, you and Richardson at 3%, and the model didn't include Al Gore. As the Democratic presidential race increasingly becomes a contest between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and to a lesser degree, John Edwards, what do you think differentiates you from the front runners?
Well, I don't think it will be that. You know, let me remind you, the same polls, same time, at this point, the last campaign, had Howard Dean the nominee. He had $50 million in the bank. He was a presumptive nominee. Our nominee, who ended up being the nominee, was number 6 and 5 in the polls in Iowa, New Hampshire, and nationally.
So you can only hope that Hillary screams or something.
No, not at all. It doesn't matter. Nobody's made up their mind. Nobody. The polls, if you underneath those polls, every pollster will tell you fewer than 10% of the American people have made their mind. Right now, this is about celebrity. This is about name recognition. And the same poll that showed Hillary with 48% of the vote showed that 49% of the people had a negative opinion about her. So the idea of what's going to end up being a major, major issue, I predict, in this election for Democrats is electability. Who can go out and win in those red states? Who can go out and win Missouri and Louisiana and Kentucky and Virginia and those places? And the question will be raised whether or not the better-known candidates now can or cannot. It's for the public to decide, but it will become a major issue.
In the AFL-CIO debate earlier this week, both you and John Edwards described your long commitment to labor. But yesterday, the AFL-CIO announced it wouldn't endorse a Democratic candidate. How does that decision affect your campaign?
Well, it affects my campaign positively in the sense that if they were to make an early decision now, they would be more likely to make a decision based upon how much money the candidates had, because the perception is how much money you have will determine how well you can do. And the fact that they did not pick, as you referred to them and others, as that either of the front runners, is an indication that of three things. One, there's a lot of good labor candidates in the field, and two, they're worried about electability too, and they do not want to. I'm not putting words in their mouth. I don't know why they made their decision, but my guess is a lot of those folks had to ask the question, if we endorse A, B, or C, can we sell them in our union hall? And I think they concluded it was too early to make that judgment.
Well, we regularly talk about campaign finance reform, and I suspect after this campaign we will bring that up again. Is there any way to clean up that mess?
There is. Public financing. I introduced the first major public financing bill in 1974 with a guy who used to be in the Senate, Dick Clark, who runs the Aspen Institute now. It is the only way, emphasize, the only way to make sure that average people have the same influence of people with money. And money is, it's obscene, the idea you need $100 million, if that's true, to run for the presidency of the United States.
My guest is Joe Biden. He's written a book called Promises to Keep on Life and Politics. It's published by Random House. Some of the candidates who aren't given much of a chance, like Dennis Kucinich, Ron Paul, and Sam Brownback, run to keep issues they consider really important in the discussion. But aren't you running as a member of the Democratic establishment?
Well, I don't think so, because if you look, I've been around a while, but I have been a bit of a contrarian. I was asked in the debate, which I might add only 1 million people out of 300 million people in America watched, so talk about whether people are focused yet on this issue. and I was asked an honest question about all this problem with bridges and infrastructure. Senator, you've been there. Aren't you part of the problem? And I pointed out that as far back as 1992, I introduced a $20 billion infrastructure bill. I've been trying to get a $900 million expenditure to make sure your tunnels, the six underneath this city, which have more people at 5 o'clock today in aluminum tubes than in 25 747s renovated. There's no escape. There's no lighting. There's no ventilation. And so I have been the guy who has been, banging at the door constantly. I have not been part of the establishment's view on taxes, the establishment's view on foreign policy, the establishment's view on infrastructure, et cetera.
President Bush just came out today against a proposed 5-cent tax on gasoline to raise funds for bridge repair and upkeep.
I'd raise funds for bridge repair by eliminating the tax cut for the top 1%. They don't need it. It's $85 billion a year. For $85 billion a year, we can repair a whole lot of the bridges.
Now, what are you going to do to calm down some of the Democratic constituency who are really upset about a number of votes in Congress? I know you didn't. You did vote for to go into Iraq or give the president the powers initially, but very quickly became a critic. But Democratic voters are upset that congressional Democrats backed down on the war spending bill, a recent one, and now angered that they've joined Republicans, at least too many of them. It is felt to give new powers to the White House on the new Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Well, you know, I was one of the authors of that Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in the late 70s, one of four people who wrote that bill. I strongly opposed the recent vote that gave the president the ability for the next 6 months to continue to act as he has, basically.
Well, how does the president get so many Democrats to go along with him at a time when his poll numbers are so incredibly low?
I think in this case it was fear. You know, the president raised the ante by through the National Security Agency about all the, quote, chatter we're hearing about potential terrorist activities. And what they bluntly said was, you know, that if, in fact, you didn't give them this authority and there were another attack, that it would be argued that if you had the authority, there wouldn't have been the attack. I think that's garbage. I think that's malarkey. But the fact of the matter is, enough Democrats crossed over and gave them that authority. I think it was absolutely wrong. And I don't blame Democrats for being angry.
You voted for the final resolution to support the war in Iraq, and then after the war you argued repeatedly for more soldiers, but now you don't support the current approach. You're also against withdrawal, so you have a third way?
Yeah, I do have a third way. I am for withdrawal. The very thing we spoke to, by the way, that everybody talks about voting on is the Biden-Levin Amendment, which says that immediately begin to draw down combat troops. Get them all out but a small contingent by March of 08. Get them out of the Civil War and get a political solution that rests upon a federal system. There's never been a time in history when there's been a self-sustaining cycle of sectarian violence in a country that it's ended remotely well without separating the parties in a federal system.
Well, we talk about a federal system. At the same time, we talk about creating a strong central government in
we
Iraq.
Can't.
How can we do the both?
We can't. I'm opposed to a strong central government in Iraq. I've been opposed to it since before the president went in. It is the central fallacy my Democratic colleagues can cling to, as well as the president. It is not possible in your lifetime or mine to have a strong central government in Iraq accepted by the Iraqi people.
So a federal system would mean, in effect, a partition?
No, it would be just that, a federal system. It would be a limited central government, control of the army, the borders, and the distribution of the wealth. It would give local control, just as we did in Bosnia in the Dayton Accords. We separated the parties within the defined boundaries of a country with limited authority to the central government, with significant authority to the regions. That's exactly what it would do. It's worked in Kosovo. In Bosnia, and it will work in, and the only thing that will work in Iraq.
So why are so many people opposed to it, including all of the Iraqi politicians?
Well, that's not true. Not all Iraqi. The present.
Well, the Kurds
leadership
would like to have something. No. Well, they'd like to have Kurdish independence.
No, yeah, but they finally figured out if they have independence, the Turks are going to invade them. There'll be a war. So that's why they support what I'm proposing. That's why you have a number of the leaders in the Iraqi government and in the Iraqi tribal leadership supporting. That's why you have a vast majority of the intellectuals in this country now supporting that position.
So this
that's
is based on the Dayton Accords?
It's based on, similar to the Dayton Accords, it's based on the notion of a federal system. The Iraqi Constitution says, in Article 1, we are a decentralized federal system. It says in Articles 1, 15, 16, 17, and 18, if you want to become a region under our Constitution, this is how you vote. And so it just calls for the implementation of their Constitution.
Do you think that this plan only has a chance if you're elected president?
No, it has a chance whoever were president, if they're willing to give it a chance. But you cannot continue to cling to the notion that you're going to have a strong, central, unified government in Baghdad to be able to control the country. And that's what the president continues to cling to. It will. There is no trust of the government. There's no trust within the government. And there's no capacity from the central government to deliver the services necessary.
So what happens, Joe, if, and I know this is almost impossible to imagine, if you don't win the Democratic nomination and
now you're being
a
wise guy. Now, up to now, you're being wise. Everybody likes a guy, but nobody likes a wise guy. But go ahead, wise guy.
Now, what happens then? You're going to stay in the Senate?
I'm chairman of the. Assuming I run again and am reelected, I'd be chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee and begin to continue to try to have an influence on the administration.
Now, you're not going to go to the forum tonight. Do these forums and debates really make a
which forum is tonight?
The LGBT forum.
There must be. Oh, I know why I'm not going to the forum, because I committed
scheduling
to
problem.
Do this this book tour. I'm trying to remember. There's so many.
Well,
forums.
we have only 15 seconds left, but I guess they are not the ultimate deciders. Only the president is. Joe Biden promises to keep. It's published by Random House.
Thank you,
and I want to thank you so much for being.
And I'm going to be your president, old buddy.